This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
So welcome everybody to this roundtable discussion about yourselves, your magical practice, what folklore means to you and how folklore acts on the practices that you follow. Let's start, because this is an audio podcast and people can't see what you look like but need to hear what you sound like. Just introduce yourselves and say a little bit about the particular practices that you follow and areas that you're interested in, starting with you, Blake.
All right. Hi, I'm Blake Malloway. I'm one of the founders of Cross Crow Books, based out of Chicago. We're a publishing house. I practice, I just call it witchcraft. I tend to, you know, pull in bits and pieces from, you know, traditions that just kind of work for me and kind of build my own practice from that. Use a lot of folklore, which is why we're here.
Excellent. Jack.
I'm Jack D. Hawkins, author of Elemental Spirits, among others. My practice is a combination of folkloric type practices and chaos magic, basically, which I see as quite closely related.
Wick.
I'm Wick Malloway, the other one of the Cross Crow Yahoos, and also own the Malloway Rose Shop in Chicago with Blake. I'm big on folk magic, all kinds of mythologies. I like feeding into a lot of that. I also work a lot with crossroads magic and animism, a lot of plant work, anything that's really tedious magic and really gets hands in and dirty. That's my favorite kind of stuff to work with.
Excellent. And Albert.
I'm Albert Bjerdshiel. I'm originally from Sussex, so most of my practice is a mixture of Sussex folk magic and also Icelandic folk magic, now that I live in Iceland. Lots of magical staves and plant magic. Yeah, that's the title of my book, Icelandic Plant Magic, so that makes sense.
That's a good immediate first plug. Always wise. Always wise. How did we all become interested in kind of folklore and magic? Was it from an early age for everybody?
Yeah, I know for me, it definitely was. Like, I'm really big into storytelling, TVs, movies, comic books, storybooks, all that stuff was really big for me. And I think, like, really being able to get, like, deeper into it is kind of what folklore is all about. It's, like, going beyond the surface level, and I think that really spoke to me.
Yeah. I think, for me, I was really, you know, interested in the why that we do things. I mean, you can go pick up a book and do that, buy books, you know, that talk about witchcraft and magic and spells, and it says to do this, do this, do this, and say these words, and then all of a sudden you have this. But I think for me, the folklore helped to answer the why behind the reason we do the things that we do, kind of connects the dots for me.
Mm. It sort of connects the humanity of it. My earliest reading was more in the ritual magic sort of area, and yet I moved into more folk magic, witchcraft type practices. Just over time, it just seemed to naturally flow to find something that actually connected the human spirit with the sort of spiritual world.
Mm. Yeah, I think for me, pop culture maybe was the beginning, like TV shows like Charmed and Buffy and things like that.
Yeah.
And then from that into Wicca, but not initiated in any Wicca, just eclectic. And then, yeah, plants and runes and things, and moving more towards folkloric with... I was living in Brighton where Doreen Valiente was living, and so I was reading a lot of her stuff, and she talks a lot about folklore in one of her books. So that sort of got me into that.
Thinking about the media, you say pop culture, and sort of the media more generally, what are your views on the representations of magic and magical practices in the media these days? And I mean, that can be anything from TV and film to print media and social media now, I guess, as well.
I think think social media leaves quite a lot to be desired. not to judge. But I think a lot of, like, especially TikTok stuff is very, like, do this thing in 5 minutes.
And which talk is a thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I as all of us, most of us probably, we are forced to use social media for promotional purposes and things like that. I do not have a TikTok account. I'm proud to not have a TikTok account.
I don't have one either.
I don't intend to have a TikTok account. I don't feel that I'm the sort of person that falls within the TikTok demographic necessarily. Other platforms work better for me. But it is a big thing for promoting these kinds of things, isn't it?
Yeah, it's big for promoting. Sure, there's a lot of authentic practices being promoted on there, but it's also a platform for people to promote garbage, for lack of a better word.
Misinformation.
Yeah.
But isn't every platform a platform for that ultimately?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, you're publishers, so what makes a good magical book?
Yeah.
You know, there's a long history of from grimoires through to the present day. What makes a good magical book?
We look at that internally. Every time we get a submission, you know, some of the first things that we do before we even look at the content is to look at the author. We want to make sure that the author is, you know, somebody who practices, who's, you know, living up to what they're writing about and isn't just cranking this out for the sake of cranking it out, you know. Albert's a great example. Like, you had an entire history. I mean, all of your social media is just filled with you doing the work, right? Oh, look at this that I found. Check out this workshop that I'm hosting. Like, you did the work. And that's the kind of stuff that's really important to us when we're looking at, you know, who gets a contract, who doesn't get a contract.
Yeah. I think if stuff is, like, really applicable, like, that's super important. You can see a lot of times opening of a book and sort of just, like, people, like, going from Disney Channel and, like, I'm going to put these rhymes together. And, like, that's a spell. These witches will take anything. And I think, like, it's really easy to be able to see, like, no, this is Dr. Seuss that you're giving us. We're going to need a little bit more than that. And a lot of that is kind of, like, the folklore itself, to bring it back to that, is you can see where their symbolism, even if they're not really saying, like, this is where my symbolism lies, like, you can feel it in there. You know that there's a connection, and that's going to be really important for a good spell.
Yeah, we have, I know the author is not here, but The Tameless Path by Camden is coming out this fall
of 2024.
And some of their spells that they have in the book, they use, like, nursery rhymes for, which I just think is, I mean, it's just brilliant, you know? Like, it's just the nursery rhymes that they're using for the incantations, but they still have the magical system behind it, which is fascinating.
It's so good.
Yeah.
What about other media representations, film, TV? Where is it done? I know, it's a kind of divisive subject.
I love it.
Where is it done well, and where, without getting litigious, is it not done well?
I have opinions on this.
Opinions are good. These are just opinions.
I feel like this is probably something a lot of people disagree with, but I usually feel like the more, like, fearsome or intense a witch is shown, I think it holds a lot of power. And I know a lot of people really want the witches to kind of seem more, like, approachable and good, because we should have, like, a good PR face. But I think, like, witchy villains are strong. Like, that's something that really does kind of pull a lot of, like, wonder out of the idea of being a witch, and makes you sort of want to tap into that mantle and sort of be empowered by it. I'm not saying, like, go out and eat children, like, do whatever you want. I'm not suggesting that. But I think there is something powerful about the idea of the witches in media being something that has this sort of, like, dark aura around it and really wants you sort of want, like, dig into yourself.
The dark and mysterious is appealing. That's why a lot of, especially young witches, they wear black and they look very attractive with their, you know, long dyed black hair and lots of eyeliner and that sort of thing. And unfortunately, sometimes that's about as far as it goes, rather than learning to practice properly.
Yeah, they use it as an aesthetic.
That's
I will say something that just... Oh, right. So, I think all of us here, you know, I don't know about all of us, but, like, we were on the original Charmed. Like, that was our idea of what it means to be a cool witch, right? Demon fighting, ass kicking, you know, witch. And, like, that was pretty inspirational back in the day, you know, and they did a really good job of weaving in a lot of, like folklore into the show. I mean, they got some stuff wrong. Hollywood had to embellish for the sake of, you know, viewership, but they have the Book of Shadows. They talk about, you know, the Wiccan Reed. Even some of their demons come from actual folklore. They incorporated a lot of demons from the Goetia into the ones that they were vanquishing every week.
Yeah, they added just enough to wet your palate. Yeah. Don't look too deep into it.
Right.
I've actually never seen Charmed.
Really?
Oh, God, you gotta do it.
You gotta watch the original one with Shannon Doherty. Not the reboot that they did. It's not.
I presume it'll be on YouTube.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Or, yeah, Netflix.
Yeah, and streaming services are good for this. We've had Trolls recently on Netflix, looking at Albert's Icelandic area as well.
They've also just, not specifically folk magic, but folklore-inspired stuff. I've just seen they're redoing Ronja Rövardotter, like the Ronja the Robber's Daughter from Astrid Lindgren. It's Swedish, like, lots of Swedish kids know this story, and it's like, there's trolls, there are these, like, night hag creatures, like, all that sort of thing. And that actually looks really good. So
there's some other long-running shows that have done it well, I think, as well. Grimm was really good for folkloric creatures. That worked well. And there's a lot of good stuff in Supernatural as well.
Supernatural. Oh my gosh, their system was, you know, I love Supernatural. Until God had a sister. That's when I was kind of like, well, I feel like we're stretching here a little bit.
As you said, Hollywood have to embrace.
early episodes, I think there was a lot of good stuff in there.
They had fantastic stuff, especially getting into, like same with Grimm. Like, they went into a lot of folklore that was a lot deeper and, like, more researched than they really kind of ended up doing later on, where they watered down a lot of the stories. But, like, they dug into it.
Have you guys seen Sanctuary, A Witch's Tale?
No.
It's on AMC back home. They would get it out. I mean, yeah, it's set in the UK, so I imagine they would.
I don't know. It's hard to find at home, so I don't know if that's much easier to find.
But it's a new series that just dropped. And it's really cool because it portrays witchcraft in such a real, tangible way. Like, the spell structures in there all make sense. Like, the ingredients they're using all come from actual folklore for their spells. It's even got, like, a nice tinge of, like, magical realism for it, which means there's not going to be a whole lot of, you know, sparks flying out of your finger. Like, it's, you know what I mean? Like, magical realism. And it really does give, like, a more modern view of the folkloric village witch. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it has sort of, like, a modern retelling of what it would be like today if witches were persecuted for witchcraft like they were back in the day. And it's, like, I could see this happening, so it's a little bit scary, but it's good drama.
Yeah.
Those of us of a certain age will remember children's programs as being very dark in terms of folklore and myth and all of these sorts of things. And then later on they became very kind of twee and
wicked witches.
Didn't really follow
that. H.R. Puffin stuff. And
yeah, exactly.
Witchy people?
Yeah.
Is that what it's
called? On HR Puff and stuff, yeah.
Oh, cool.
But I think we're coming round now to being able to treat children less differently to adults in terms of the media and programming. We're within certain boundaries that obviously need to be followed. So I think children got short shrift for a while, but I think now there's quite good stuff out there for younger people as well.
Yeah, for sure. There is a lot of stuff that is kind of like a... Like, I always say this, but Disney's big thing was that they didn't just make stuff for children, they made stuff for the children in everyone.
Yeah.
And then that kind of got, like, taken away a little bit, and now it's coming back again where it's again, for the children and everyone. So, like, adults and children can enjoy and watch the same thing.
And, of course, those of us that have books on the subject coming out can cite Scooby-Doo as being good for this, too.
Well, no, shameless plug, don't
we? Yeah. I'm going to plug my own stuff, too. but that's done really well for representing witchcraft particularly. There are some excellent examples in that, too. So I don't think, you know, where stuff is not dumbed down, I think it's done very well.
Yeah, there's... Hilda, I think, if you've seen that one, that's very good.
It's so good. It's really so good. Freaking good. Yeah.
Yeah, that's all kind of like a... Where is that based? Is that Iceland or is that Sweden? Something. But it's a lot of, like, tons of folklore in there, which is also, like, very witchy, but it goes all over the place.
Yeah. I forgot about that one.
I think a lot of the transition over several decades has been a lot of the old fairy tales have wicked witches. You've got the one in the gingerbread house that eats children and all that. And then yes. Wicca started getting very popular a few decades ago. And that sort of put a kinder face on witchcraft, you might say. Mm-hmm. And everybody wanted to be witches rather than being afraid of witches.
Yeah.
That's what
You know, and yes. I feel like I'm really glad that a lot of movies are being made now about the backstories of the villains, which in a lot of stories are witches, because the witches are justified in a lot of these cases. You don't want to be eaten, don't eat the witch's house, and she wouldn't have cooked you, right?
Like, I think that's fair.
Keep your hands to yourself. You ate my house. Like, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, I would have been pissed too.
Yeah, absolutely.
This could so easily be edited to just make us sound like villains.
I know.
It's a good Facebook meme that says, why are we afraid of the witch? And we should be afraid of the people who burnt them.
Yeah.
Ooh,
that's good.
That's
yeah.
deep. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
What do you think about ideas of witchcraft as a practice versus ideas of witchcraft as a religion?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I have
question.
So many thoughts on that.
Witchcraft as a practice and Wicca as a religion. That's my division.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that is the, on most levels, that's a division that people would come down with, isn't it? That witchcraft wasn't really a religion until Gardner
1954. Yeah.
decided that it was because he should be the head of it.
Yeah.
It's interesting watching independent witches sort of follow the Wiccan ritual methods and such that have developed since then.
Mm.
Because that's what's out there in books for the most part. You don't find as many about the basics of witchcraft, which is based in folklore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we struggle with this in the shop, in our shop in Chicago. Well, we don't really struggle with it, but we get a lot of new folks that are coming in who think that, you know, Wicca is the end-all be-all to witchcraft, right? Like, they think every witch they meet is Wiccan. And, I mean, I got my background. I started on Scott Cunningham, Silver Raven Wolf. Like, I was 11 years old with my teen witch walking through my sixth grade class. Like, I'm such a hardcore witch right now. It fills in an amazing whole. Like, it's a fantastic starter point for people that need that transition out of mainstream religion into something a little bit more mystical and magical. But I find that I don't like to use the word, anytime you use a title, right? Like, it just can be very limiting on what your practice is, which is why I said in the beginning, I'm just a witch. I just practice witchcraft. Mm. You know, it's not Wiccan witchcraft. It's not hedge witchery. It's not green witchery. It's not fill in the blank with anything else you want witchery. It's just witchcraft. And because I try to not limit myself like that, I have a much easier time viewing it as a practice versus a religion, if that makes sense.
Mm. That does make sense.
Yeah.
I think for me, the sort of distinction between like animism and religion, at least in Iceland, it's like we acknowledge the spirits and everything. You don't necessarily like revere stuff in the same way that you would in a religious way.
Yeah.
But you have like some, or like not everyone, but most people who are doing that sort of stuff in Iceland have this idea of you need to have this respect for the elves and the trolls and all the spirits. They don't look at that as a religion. It's just sort of, that's just the way you behave.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's just be good because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I think that's it. Cause that is kind of, witchcraft is in a weird spot where like you do have access to like talking to these spirits and gods. And I think there's not a lot of other things where you're able to come in contact with gods and it not be a religion, but there's definitely a way to do it in witchcraft where it's more like a conversation instead of like a form of worship or any kind of dogma around it. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of just almost do like a trade, like I'm going to do this and then you can do this and then we'll just make magic together.
I think the biggest difference that I've noticed between the people that view it as a religion and the people that view it as a practice is, again, this is just my perspective. I just want to throw that out there.
Noted.
Right. Is if, you know, someone does a spell and the spell doesn't turn out the way they want it to, the people that view it as a religion tend to say, well, the universe didn't want me to have this. The god and goddess had other plans for me. You know, fill in the blank with whatever reason that's not their own for their spell not turning out the way they wanted it to. But the people that view it as a practice first and foremost, again, from my experience, are like, well, I screwed up that spell. Let me try it again and figure out where I went wrong, you know?
Yeah.
So I feel like on the practice side of it, there's a lot more accountability for the witch, which can be nerve-wracking, you know? Like,
oh yeah, that could maybe, that I think is like a good thing to point out. And I don't know if this tracks with a lot of religions, but I think with witchcraft as a practice, it's definitely more about self-empowerment versus in a religion, a lot of times it's sort of like, the empowerment through something else or the empowerment of something else to help you. But witchcraft, a lot of that is sort of like your own evolution.
It's for making your life better. Like, that's what witchcraft is for. Religion focuses on, you know, making sure your afterlife is taken care of, and witchcraft is for making sure your life here is taken care of. You know, and that's why we have so many spells folklorically. Bringing it back around. You know, focus on things like, you know, how to ensure your crops are healthy, how to make sure your cow is giving milk, you know, because that's what they needed to make life better. That's my soapbox on that.
Jack and I were talking in the interview that we recorded this morning as well about the fact that lots of practices are very personal to people as well. So you might be drawing on folklore, you might be drawing on older beliefs, older practices, you might be drawing on spells that you've seen in another book.
Yep.
But you still make it your own, and that's not how religion works, is it? You don't look at the Bible, for example, to look at Christian religion and go, I'm going to use that part and that part, but I'm going to change that slightly to suit what I'm doing. And, you know, people get grumpy when you do stuff like that with religion. But with your own practices, you shape them to your own needs, don't you? And that's what gives them value.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Yeah. I think, you know, we were chatting about some of Gemma's writings earlier and absolutely love her writings. Traditional witchcraft, A Cornish Book of Ways, is one of my first introductions into non-mainstream Wicca. And what was cool about it was it talked about all of these folkloric sites in the West Country. You know, you had the Menantole, you had the Loganstone, and we can't visit those places regularly in Chicago. So we had no choice but to adapt and to make it something that was based off of our own landscape. You know, we may not have the holy wells, but we got a hose down the street that go wash our faces, you know.
but in terms of folklore as well, that's really relevant, because if you look at old folkloric practices like wassailing, for example, not everybody has an apple orchard in their back garden, so they're not going to go and bless their own trees. But now you see a lot of wassails taking place on the high street. So, you know, off licenses who sell cider, which is made from apples, will have wassails outside the shop to bless the shop. And it follows these old practices, but in an urban environment.
Yeah.
That's like how a lot of folklore starts. Like, it's supposed to be very local and just in one spot. And then sort of as it gets more popular, it grows. Like, the folklore itself should also shift as it moves to different areas.
Yeah, well, yes, exactly. It reacts to what's going on around it. And, you know, it changes and shapes in all sorts of different ways depending on that. You know, there's this kind of misbelief about folklore from a lot of people that it's just old stuff. and you know, it's not just old stuff, otherwise we wouldn't have digital folklore, and we wouldn't have online folklore, and we wouldn't have memes and all of the, you know, this is all folklore, and it all feeds into the same cultural melting pot, doesn't it?
Yeah, like creepypastas are a really good example of that. Yeah. They're all like the scary stories on Reddit, and they're spooky and they're good.
Yeah. And Slenderman, for example, was, you know, the very first episode of this podcast like 100 years ago was about Slenderman, and that's exactly that. And that's why that was such an interesting creature within folklore, because it didn't exist until creepypasta. It was created purely for that, but then it became so much more. And then it got to the stage where people started to be not sure about its origins, and people didn't know whether it was an actual supernatural entity or it was a creation. And then we obviously had the tragic Texas case of the schoolgirl stabbings, which were related to it, and it just went on and grew. And it's really interesting that you actually got an origin point there. And we see it again now. I think we're starting to see it again now with developments in AI, for example. Yeah. And we haven't covered this in any detail yet, but Loeb, who is this creepy-looking AI-generated female form, which crops up in all sorts of places, the same argument is being applied there. Was that figure created by an artist originally, and it's now being scraped by AI and popping up in all sorts of other places? Or did AI generate it itself, and now it's self-perpetuating?
Just, like, that's interesting too, because it's sort of like people would like folklore more, maybe, or they'll accept it more if they don't know where it comes from. Mm. So it's something where they're like, oh, this is kind of like a mysterious origin, and it kind of like helps your imagination grow with it a little bit. Like, maybe it's real, maybe it's coming from a source that's something that's kind of like more divine or godly, versus like Slender Man. I think when people look back on it, they find like, oh, this specific photoshopped picture is where it comes from. They're like, oh, and the wind goes out of their sails. But it's still a spooky story. Like, it gets really cool.
Goes out of their sails. Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
I like that.
Imagery and symbols form their own personalities, and that's how a lot of deities are made.
Yeah.
I was going to say, too, you know, I think one of my draws to Cornwall specifically in the past has obviously been the Witchcraft Museum. But, you know, I'm from Michigan originally. And Michigan has its own culture that just seems so separate from everywhere else in the United States. You know, we have, I mean, the further north you go, that's where you run into like the fudge and stuff like that that comes from up north. You've got, you know, I totally lost my train of thought. Pasties, which I'm like, oh, this is a Michigan thing, right? Like, come on, this is only in Michigan, no one else. And then you realize, oh, everybody that settled northern Michigan came from Cornwall because we have the copper mines. The only people that knew how to work in the copper mines were the people working in the tin mines in Cornwall.
Yes.
So they came and brought all of their folklore with them that just kind of stayed in Michigan.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we're raised in Michigan being taught about this stuff, but we don't know where it comes from. And it wasn't until a couple of years ago that I learned that people from Cornwall actually call us Cousin Jacks and Cousin Janes because we're so closely connected. You know?
Yeah, the same is true of Newfoundland as well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of parallels between folklore in the southwest of the UK and Newfoundland for the same reason.
Yeah.
It's this migration of people to go and work the mines and so on. I think I've said to you before as well about the draw of Cornwall.
Yeah.
As a Devon resident, you know, the draw of Cornwall is that you have to drive through Devon to get here. that's the draw of Cornwall.
But like it's so like, you know, and these aren't things that we thought about growing up. It's just, oh yeah, this is what we do. It's a Michigan thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Just like, I don't know, Florida's known for its heat. Michigan's known for its pasties. You know?
Is that what Florida's known for?
I don't know what Florida's known for.
Alligators.
Yeah, alligators. There we go.
You're being very nice to Florida right now.
But yeah, I don't know. It's just interesting.
Who's doing a lot in terms of witchcraft and folklore now in the public sphere to represent it well, do you think, authors and practitioners?
I'm looking, you guys can't see, but we're all eyeing Albert right now.
I mean, I'm lucky in that not a lot of people in Iceland are talking about this, so it's sort of, I have the interest and I have the passion for sure, but I feel like I'm one of the only people talking about that really on like an international sort of level,
because there's a lot of monopoly on that.
Yeah, which I'm more than happy to share if other people want to as well. But
it would be interesting to get you and Tommy Kusala in the same room. I don't know whether you know Tommy, but Tommy works at Uppsala University,
okay,
in Sweden, and in the folklore department there, and is very, very knowledgeable about Swedish folklore and traditions. And I think the crossover between, we were talking about when we were speaking earlier on today, Scandinavian folklore and Icelandic folklore and the migratory patterns taking stories to and from, that would be an interesting discussion to put
there's
in one
quite
room.
A lot as like even just reading books on Trolldom, there's quite a lot of stuff in there that I thought was specifically Icelandic, like methods of getting stones from animals that do cure various things or make you invisible or things like that. There's almost the exact same thing in Sweden. Not the exact same animals, but like the same sort of methods of like you take a some are not very nice, of like you're supposed to kill the baby birds in a nest so that the mum will like go and find a stone that she then brings back that resurrects all the birds, and then you wait for her to drop the stone, and then you have a stone for resurrection or for healing. And there's the exact same folklore in Sweden that there is in Iceland with that.
Yeah, that's really fascinating to me. I mean, you see that with a lot of spells where, you know, in this part of the country, it'll be do this with these words.
And then, you know, someplace 150 miles away, it'll be do the same thing with slightly different words. And it's just cool how the methodology is the same and the structure is the same and the words are very close. There's a love spell that's coming to mind where I've seen multiple incarnations of. It's the...
It's not the blood I mean to burn.
But my lover's heart I mean to turn. Yeah, that one. Yeah. And there's just slight variations depending on where you're reading the spell manifest from. Which is really fascinating because it's not like they had email 200 years ago.
There's one too. There's a spell that kind of reminded me of your bird one. Where I know there's like a love spell where you like you take a bird's nest of baby birds and like you bury them until they starve to death, and then you like open it up and see like which of the mouths are open, which ones are closed, and the ones that are open. Like you can use that to bring in love, and the ones that are closed use that to bring in hate. So it's like, okay, there's a lot of mean things you can do to birds that's very magical.
Yeah. I do like the idea though of, maybe this is just, you know, hopeful thinking that people weren't actually doing this to animals, but you know, maybe the actual method of the spell was only for the people who were trained. So like to the casual onlooker, it's going to look like you have to do all this ridiculous stuff. Mm. But to people that were, you know, in the magical current of the time, they knew how to read past that and see the actual instructions for the working.
I think a few nasty things happened in history. I mean, I have skulls sitting there to drink out of. Yes. Where do you think that came from?
I think you're right. Yeah. I think it was the Museum of Witchcraft in Boscastle. They had a display once of a skull that they found on top of a hill that mm-hmm. was known for witches gathering and stuff like that. Yeah. And so you're right, bad stuff did happen.
Yeah. I think animals got a raw deal in a lot of these.
Yeah. Evolved since then
a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, I think in terms of folk medicine, certainly there's a lot of animal based folk medicine, isn't there? And I think there probably still is in some cases. And I wonder whether that is changing with more modern views on animals generally, animal welfare, animals as food, the rise of vegetarianism and vegan diets. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that, yeah, maybe Albert, you're the best person to address this one. Does this mean that some of those folk practices are changing to represent that?
I think, like, not related at all to what I do, but I know that, like, the use of bear bile in Chinese medicine is, like, there's a lot of work being done against that now. Mm. So that's, like, one example. But, like, a lot of Icelandic folk magic is, like, take the blood from a dog, a seal, a cat, mix it with your blood, and paint this seal and stuff. And one thing that I try to do, at least in classes on this, is I'm looking a lot at plant stuff and how powerful plants can be and how we can maybe work plants instead of blood in some places. Because there's some magic where blood is like, that would be the ideal thing to use. Ideally, like from yourself and not from all these animals. But I found at least like there's ways to work plants, grinding resins and getting like gathering lots of plant material and sort of squishing it down until you get like a juice from the plant. That's like one thing I've been experimenting with that seems to work quite well. So I guess maybe that might be, not that it's accurate to the folklore, but that might be
a good
alternative.
Yeah,
do you use cauldron magic at all, where you're throwing your plants into the cauldron and stirring, you know, like Macbeth style?
I should, yeah. I don't tend to, but I should.
I do that myself.
I know, I do too. We should get like a new cooking pot. But we can do that in an actual
drink. You can get traditional cauldron-shaped vessels of all sorts.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some pathways that require some of this. So like heathenism, for example, you know, animal sacrifice can be an important part of that, can't it? But is that likely to change even?
Within my group, because we're sort of a mix. Like some people are more into the Alsathru and heathenry. But then, like, some of us are more folk witchy. Mm. We use, like, beetroot juice for those who don't want to use blood.
Oh, yeah, right.
So that's the alternative. Like, we'll have them side by side, but it's like then you get to choose if you want to use this or...
And do you find that people are accepting of those changes generally? Yeah. Or because you'll always find some stalwarts of any practice that go, well, that is purely wrong and you cannot do it that way and it will not work.
Actually, interestingly, in like Alsathru in Iceland, there's like... a lot of the actual doing of the magic is not really seen as something that's like respectable or worth people's time. There's quite a lot of divide between like, oh no, this is a serious faith and we need to be very serious about this and not live in a fantasy world. And then other people being like, this is what the books say, so...
Yeah.
That is a big... Yeah. Like, there is kind of like a returning to a lot of traditional practices, and I think that is something that people are saying, like, this is what it says in the book. You want to go back to the tradition specifically because they find a lot of power in that, but you know, traditions also should evolve at some
point. They should,
so,
yeah.
Like, find where to go back and where to move forward.
Well, they don't have a choice but to evolve. Like, I think us... You know, looking at a lot of the traditional, I'm using air quotes here, practices that we, use to inspire our practices back home. Like, we can't go sit at the Menantol and meditate, you know? Like, we can't go to the, St. Nectan's waterfall and, like, wash our hands in there to, you know, like, we can't do this stuff at home. So things have to evolve if they're going to keep going.
Talk a little bit about you. You mentioned your shop. At the top of this, so this is an occult shop, for want of a better term. I don't know how you would like to describe it. That's the term that I'm going to use for the sake of argument, because it paints a picture for people. What sorts of areas are you looking at in terms of retail of this stuff? Because that sometimes has a bit of a bad press. And again, this comes back to some more modern pathways, which are very much kind of, you know, here's a shelf of candles and here's a book of love spells and that's all you need. And actually, you know, what we've been talking about shows that it's a little bit more involved than that. So how do you approach this from a retail perspective?
We go like all over the place with it. So I know we try to have like a good selection. If someone wants to come in and do magic, that they can find anything for any type of magic. But we do make sure that everything we have in the shop is ethical. If it's in a plant that would normally be endangered, we make sure that it's coming from like a farmed area so that it's something that's a lot safer. Animals that, like, we have bones in the shop, but they're all ones that are kind of taken from like roadkill, or ones that died naturally, or someone was hunting things and they had like extra bits that they're like, oh, just send that to the followers.
Well, and that's one of the cool parts is, I mean, we've become people's first point of contact for this stuff. Like, hey, I've got this horse skull from a horse that died 10 years ago on my farm. Do you guys want it? We're like, yep, we'll take it. you know?
Yeah.
And like, that's why there's, I mean, you can get your basics, of course. We'd be stupid shop owners if we didn't have candles and incense and stuff like that.
Of course.
But, you know, a lot of the animal parts that we get, it's get it while it's there, because we don't have somebody on speed dial to give us cat bones. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's you're going to get it while it's there. I hope I'm not bursting anyone's bubble with this, but in a lot of hoodoo practices, black cat bones are a very common magical ingredient, and usually when you buy them, they're an actual bone that's been painted black, and those are just chicken bones that they paint black.
Yeah,
right. We were fortunate to have actually sourced ethically some black cat bones that were actual black cat bones from a cat that passed away of old age. You know, so we were able to put the entire animal to use, which from a magical perspective I think is beautiful. And, you know, we had for 2 weeks actual black cat bones that you can't get anywhere else. And once they're gone, that's it.
Yeah. And, like, there are a lot of things. Because we do spells in the shop for people. And I think that's sort of where there's a weird line. And we always try to make sure that, like, there are certain spells that we won't cast. But then we leave it to, like, their own discretion and be like, okay, well, we're not going to cast it. But here are things you can do if you want to cast a spell by yourself. And sort of, like, their morals can be theirs, our morals can be ours, and we just draw that line.
Yeah. And that's an interesting angle, actually, because a lot of shops are just shops, and you go there to buy stuff. But this is more than a shop in terms of its approach, isn't it? So, yes, you know, you talk about spellcasting being a service, if you like, and service magicians have always been around.
Yeah.
And then, you know, shops like Albert's got his book launch tonight in Treadwell's in London, for example. This is a bookshop, but they do lots of live events, you know, and that's a big draw and a big thing as well. So I think in this kind of area, the area of magical practices and folkloric tradition, all these kinds of things, shops are not just shops, are they? They're community hubs almost for this sort of thing, and that's really important.
We're very big about the community with our shop. Like, it's become like a hub in Chicago, in the greater Chicago region, really, for like magical practice. So like we do all the Sabbats, all the full moons are celebrated out there. I mean, we do, you know, spell consultations for people. We have our Fair of Fortunes that we do like every couple of months where people come in and read. I'm always super flattered when we have like an event and people are like, oh my gosh, I flew up here from Florida for this. And we're like, what?
It's not worth it.
It's not worth it. Have you met us?
Yeah. But I was talking to someone else like a few days ago, and this just like, I thought it was a really interesting take on it, but she was saying how like pagans and witches, they don't have churches. So the idea of a shop is the closest thing that they have. So that is an area where they can gather. Whether or not like it is a shop that has events and services doesn't really matter as much. It's just a place to meet other people.
And to feel comfortable doing it. That's why I get so pissed off when I go into a shop and an occult shop. They have no idea who we are, you know, and they're just so cold and standoffish and they look miserable being there. I'm like, we get to go home and cast spells. Like, why are you so unhappy? Right? Like, come on.
I think if you are unhappy in an environment like that, then the environment is not what you expect it to be, isn't it? And it is this kind of, it's a communal place. It's a gathering space. And that's how it should be used.
Yeah.
I want to finish off with one topic for discussion, which I've asked a lot of people who have come on as guests recently, because everybody has different opinions on this. And I normally ask it from the point of view of folklore only, but we can broaden it out today and look at it in terms of witchcraft and magic as well, because I think it's equally as sound in that area as well. So in terms of those things, we're looking now at a modern resurgence of interest, I believe. And we've seen this historically before. In the Victorian and Edwardian period, there's a resurgence of interest in folklore, particularly because upper-class white men who have lots of money and nothing else to do go out and collect it. And then they interpret it really badly, but that's part of the past. And we accept that now and we move on from it. But they did a lot of good work, to be fair, collecting and preserving this material. And then post-war, we see another resurgence of interest in this. And this time it's from a point of view probably of the end of a particularly traumatic and troubling time, and the importance of community and nostalgia and getting back those things that were prior to that. And now, 21st century, I think we see another resurgence of interest in all of these things. We've seen it online and social media, some big social media groups in this area that have formed. Folk horror revival on Facebook is a prime example of where it grew really quickly and had a massive following of people who didn't always actually understand exactly what folk horror is, but knew that they were interested in that area. And folklore, we've seen a similar thing with. And I would argue witchcraft and magical practices as well. But I think everybody has different opinions as to why now we have, again, this resurgence of interest. So I throw it open to anybody to give your opinions as to why you think we have this kind of modern resurgence of interest in these areas.
Well, there's going to be various subgroups within this interest. I lurk on some witchcraft groups on Facebook. And there's a lot of young witchlings that brag about how many books they got for $5 each, which, of course, all say the same thing with different pretty pictures on them. And they're looking for something to you know, make them some money because they're desperate, or to make their lives better in some way. I think in these days we're having a lot of trouble just trying to keep up with the cost of living and, you know, the political things going on, all sorts, and people are looking for some miracle to pull them out of it. So there is a bit of a desperation aspect to especially the younger people there. Well, there will be other groups and, of people that have different reasons for taking their interest.
That's a good point. Desperation, like it is almost like there's a necessity in here, and I feel like witchcraft can offer people that sort of necessity.
Yes, I've done my spell jar. How come I don't have a bunch of money? You can explain it to them, but they don't listen if you do.
Did you light your candle?
That's a good question.
And it's true. Like, it kind of seems like you can track it almost, like the ebb and flow of these. Like every 30 years. Like, there's the 60s, which was really big in witchcraft, and then it kind of, like, started to ebb away, and then the 90s came back again, and that was really big in witchcraft. It started to ebb away again, and now we're, like, here in the 20s, which now it's, like, all kind of coming back, so it will kind of start to fade away again, but it is sort of, like, every 30 years.
So that's an interesting point, because in terms of folklore, we talk about generational folklore. So we see the laying of ghosts, for example, for 99 years or 66 years being important figures. And that's because generationally, 33 years is classed as a generation. So do you think it ties in with this? Is it a generational interest in these things? So every 30 years, we have a new generation of people who are the right age and the right mindset to become interested in this. And then, for whatever reason, it dies away, as you say.
I think it very much can, because usually it's like sort of like the generation that's in charge, which is going to like mark that time period. Mm. So like even if like the people who are aging out of it are still into it, you're not really going to be paying attention to them as much as sort of like the figureheads.
Well, I would argue, though, that with witchcraft seems to be the one thing where the older you are, the more knowledge you're thought to have, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like if the 33-year cycle could be just enough time for the kids to say, oh, my grandparents taught me this, she was a witch, you know, and that's kind of what, because it's not cool if the parents do it, but if the grandparents do it, it's really cool.
It's mystical.
I have two granddaughters. They both have Catholic mothers, that could be a problem.
Oh dear. Yeah, I don't know, that's my thought, though.
I think, like, there's the fantasy aspect, I think, in, like, pop culture especially. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's a big draw for lots of people. And then, I want to say more than half of those people will eventually be like, oh, maybe this isn't for me, when they work out what it actually is.
Yeah.
With witchcraft, for sure. So I'm not sure, maybe. I mean, there's been, like, there's always been fantasy TV and movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if maybe there's been just enough in that time period to now be, these are the people who are old enough to, who are older now when they were watching this when they were kids. But,
yeah. That raises an interesting point, actually, just finally, that just came to mind about the influence of pop culture on folklore, and probably it also will apply to magical practice as well. In that folklore has often changed and been shaped by pop culture. And if you think about black dog folklore, for example, the descriptions of black dogs have changed over time and been shaped by that. So the Victorian penny dreadfuls sort of were very tame in the way that they looked at horror and things like that. And then you go forward to kind of the 80s, 90s cinema, where topics are a bit, you know, dealt with in a bit more visceral way, and lycanthropy and American Werewolf in London is a prime example, and those sorts of things. And you see changes in the way that reports are made by people that are kind of influenced by the literature, cinema, TV, whatever. And now, I think there's a case to argue that it's going to change again based on the lack of censorship of the internet, the differences in censorship in terms of film and TV and what is shown and who to, and the streaming services that offer this kind of material. And again, the way that things like horror are written for a modern audience. And I think that's going to perhaps shape all of these things in the future again by its visceral, is possibly the right word, nature, do you think?
Yeah. I forgot what book it was. I think it was a Michael Howard book. One of the ones that he, like, West Country Witches, and one of those, where he was recounting some folklore about fairy folk and, you know, seeing them and recounting something. And one of the things that he pointed out, I think this was him, so if I'm wrong and somebody hears this, just sorry, was that as, like, society developed, these sightings also developed to match society, right? So there were stories of you know, people seeing fairies ride around on little red tricycles, you know, when red tricycles were something that was pretty commonplace, right? So it seemed like the folklore was evolving to match the society that it was being observed in, which I thought was interesting. Because, I mean, going from them running around to riding on a tricycle is cute, but I can't imagine to you know, going from that to, oh, I see a fairy on an airplane, you know?
What? I mean, there's like Gremlins. That's kind of the thing that you would see on an airplane. I think we hope
we don't see those
anymore. Right.
Well, the Twilight Zone had an episode with a gremlin on an airplane wing, didn't they?
Yeah. I think like when you have like big categories too of things like fairies or spirits or trolls or the djinn, where it's just kind of like this is a magical creature and they don't really zero in specifically what that is, people will sort of see that and they'll see something they can't explain. They're like, oh, well, that must be this thing. And then it kind of grows the folklore of that specific thing to include that new.
Yeah, it's I had an interesting example of this happen recently. We were talking about Charmed earlier. Do you remember Andrus, the spirit of rage, right? So Charmed, in the Charmed Book of Shadows, they were like, Andrus was a spirit of anger, people, you know, blah, blah, blah. And if you look at the Goetia, the actual mythology of the demon Andrus was rage and anger. But in the Charmed Book of Shadows, like, you know, they have to embellish for the sake of plot, right? They talked about how, like, what are the people that lead armies called? Like,
generals,
I guess. Yeah. I guess whatever, military people, they would invoke the spirit of Andrus to instill rage in their warriors before they went to war. Mm-hmm. And I kid you not, for a good month, I'm like, wait, was that Charmed or was that real folklore? Was that Charmed? Because it makes sense either way.
Yeah, you know?
So that's an example of how pop culture could influence the evolution of, because if I told somebody that and they didn't know that I had watched Charmed or they didn't say that I was confused about it, then I mean it could just spiral and snowball from that point.
In relation to this whole idea of modernizing the folklore, I was talking to director Richard Stanley actually about fairies. We had a wonderful conversation about this, and he came up with this idea about what if they sort of evolved with modern times and went around wearing hoodies and that sort of thing. I got the artist who did the covers of my fiction series, my goblin series, to draw a picture. You've got three fairies on some steps in San Francisco in their hoodies and modern things, a little tutu skirt on the girl. And I am going to write a story to go with this picture at some point. Like, it's on my project list.
Yeah. Why wouldn't they, right? Like, why wouldn't they adapt or evolve? Yeah.
That's such a juicy subject.
Yeah.
And I think that's like, like, all of that is sort of what makes the folklore so, like, tasty, is that, like, it can be super-duper dry for just, like, sitting in front of someone being like, here's what this fairy does, this one. But, like, you kind of put it into the storytelling and you make it with, like, with folklore or with pop culture or with your tutu book. Like, this is stuff where, like, it becomes so much more delicious to kind of like take it in and turn it into something of your own.
I think your brain is the perfect example of this, though. We could be driving through the countryside and Wick will, what's the tulip or the daffodil story you made up?
Oh, periwinkle penny knuckle.
Periwinkle penny knuckle. So we're driving through Cornwall one day. It's early spring and he's like, did you ever hear the story about periwinkle penny knuckle? And I'm like, what? Of course I did, Wick. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he just comes up with these stories like, oh yeah, periwinkle penny knuckle, she eats her stone fruit and she drops her stone fruit seeds behind and wherever they fall some daffodils pop up. And I'm like, it's so brilliant though, like it's absolutely brilliant, but it's gonna make me look like an idiot when I'm asking these people. You know, so like, you are the prime example of like inventing folklore. Actually, Wick has a book, The Witch's Book of Terribles, which is all invented folklore. Mm. There's actual real magic that's woven into it, and I'm like, it's what a brilliant way to.
I need this book. I was about to say, you must write this down.
I was going in the same way, actually. This is an argument to say, why are you not writing more?
I know, yeah. It's really cool. He published it, we like self-published it before Cross Crow kind of took off. So we're re-releasing it through like our proper channels next spring. So I'm really excited to see the revised edition of that.
That was so cool.
Okay, one final thing for each of you then, just to wrap this up. We've covered a lot of ground. If you had to recommend one person's work or practice as a good introduction for people to all of this stuff, who would you recommend as one person for the listener to look at?
I have thoughts. Should I go first?
Go for it.
Okay. I'm a really big fan of Nigel Pearson's Treading the Mill, mainly because it's accessible regardless of where you are in the world. I think he did a fantastic job of putting that book together. And I think that one was he originally published through what's that publisher that went out of business?
Capel Ban.
And I think republished through Troy. And I mean, he did a fantastic job with that book. I mean, it is the book that I wish I had on day one of me, you know, pursuing witchcraft.
Good call.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
I'd go back to the 1970s and say The Magic of Fintorn by Paul Hawken. He's a journalist. He went to visit this place where magical things were happening, where you know, sort of places where things shouldn't grow, but they had huge cabbages and gardens, and the main people were talking to fairies and such. And the way that he approaches it is you just get pulled right into this world as he discovers it. I think that'd be a good place to start, really.
Wick.
That's hard. There's so many. I feel like I have like a bunch of names going through my head right now, but New World Witchery, has anyone ever heard of that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like Corey Hutchinson, I know he does a lot with just like folklore itself and being able to really catalog stuff, go through like specifically how different folklore is able to connect, why it has this connection, what a lot of the magical systems have behind them that sort of make them magical. So like, he isn't just putting it together, he's really putting some like critical thinking and thought into it, which I'm always like, this is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
I think I would say two, I guess. So like for modern stuff that's like very in folklore inspired, Gemma Gary is, I think, really good at like, and also like one of the only authors I've seen specifically state like, hey, this is not like an actual authentic ancient tradition.
Oh,
this
yeah.
is like stuff inspired by this. So I think that's really inspirational. But then also, like for me, in like a practical way, Agrippa's three books of occult philosophy is like,
awesome.
There's
light
so much
reading.
In that. It's like, yeah, right. And like not all of them, obviously, like in one go, but as reference books, like for like the why this thing does this thing, that's very good. And especially if you're into like planetary stuff, then that's like, I think, because you could build an entire tradition just from reading and being inspired by these, so.
Yeah.
And the beauty of being host is that I do not need to answer this question.
We'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much, everybody, for taking the time. I will put links to all of the places where people can find you on the Folklore Podcast website so that they can go and find out more about what we've all been talking about. Thank
awesome.
You.
Thank you. Yeah,
thank you very much.
Woo! Good job, everyone.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.